Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg. Drop
what you're doing. In West Haven, Connecticut, there is a place called the Fire and Ice Hookah Lounge. Some of you might be familiar with what a hookah pipe is. I've never made use of one, don't intend to start. A couple of nights ago, a fellow by the name of Kevin Morris, who's a resident of West Haven, strolled into the Fire and Ice Lounge, and apparently, given the decor and the advertised purpose of this facility, which involved, of course, hookah pipes and apparently belly dancing, decided that he must be in a haven of Muslim terrorists. And so he expressed himself to that effect by hurling directionless abuse at the patrons and employees of the Fire and Ice Lounge. At one point, he reached over and grabbed a bartender by the collar, and that prompted everybody in the room to form a rugby scrum, and beat the poor fellow severely. Now, he's been charged with assault. I think that somebody else was probably guilty of the same crime, based on the photographic evidence. He's sporting, in the mugshot I saw, a fat lip and a very large shiner, so somebody laid hands violently on him as well. Looks to me like you're either going to charge both the assailant and the person who assailed the assailant, or charge neither of them. But the point I'm making is that this was not a den of terrorists. This was not a mosque. You know, belly dancing, last I heard, was not part of the religious services at any mosque. Although, from what I understand, the Turkish fleet at Lepanto engaged in belly dancing, which is sort of weird. In any case, this guy was convinced that he was doing something, I suppose, in order to express his hatred and abhorrence of Islamic terrorism, when actually people were there to get high and enjoy the spectacle of pretty dancing girls. Here's another straw in the wind. This is from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. A 35-year-old Seattle man is facing assault and hate crimes charges following allegations that he accosted a clerk at a Queen Avenue convenience store. By the way, hate crimes, that concept is utterly totalitarian. By way of principle, I can't support the idea that the government should be punishing attitudes. You can take into account motivations in terms of making a case that somebody has committed an act of aggression, but the government's got no business in enhancing penalties on the basis of bad attitudes. If he actually committed an assault, a violent assault, that's a different issue. But hate crimes is a concept right out of Orwell. It has no place in a free society, or something that aspires to be a free society. To continue now with the story. According to police, Brock Stainbrook derided the man as being a terrorist during the Tuesday morning incident. Writing to court, a Seattle detective said Stainbrook entered the 7-Eleven store. The clerk was standing near a coffee machine when Stainbrook accosted him. For unknown reasons, a person threw change on the floor near the victim's feet, then punched the victim on the left side of the head, the detective said. After the subject struck the clerk with his fist, he said, "You're not even American. You're Al-Qaeda. Go back to your country." This is in the morning. I mean, he wasn't a drunken lout, which apparently was the case with the incident in New Haven. This guy's doing this first thing in the morning before he had his coffee. After the suspect, another employee then stepped in, forcing Stainbrook to leave the store. As he did so, police alleged the man tried to kick the second employee and damaged a barcode scanner. Police arrested Stainbrook walking nearby minutes later. Confronted by police, he allegedly admitted that he, quote, struck a person on his turban because he disliked him. While the alleged victim's ethnic background is not noted in court documents, his surname is common within the Sikh community, S-I-K-H, Sikh. They're from northern India. Stainbrook has been charged with fourth-degree assault and malicious harassment, Washington State's hate crime statute. I wish that statute would be thrown out. I wish that every statute of that sort were done away with, because they've got no purpose apart from promoting racial and ethnic collectivism and further envenoming relations among people on the basis of what should be legally inconsequential characteristics. And quite frankly, for the most part, hate crime statutes are used to punish things that white people do, rather than being used uniformly to punish crimes of hatred. They're primarily directed at white people. Let's be blunt about that. that it doesn't matter whether they're directed to white people, brown people, yellow people, or people from Betelgeuse, or Betelgeuse, I believe is how you pronounce the name of that star, or any planet orbiting that star. They're bad. In any case, this guy wasn't a Muslim. He was a Sikh. Now, if you remember, in the days following 9/11, there were a couple of incidents, I believe one in Arizona, there might have been one in Kansas, in which Sikhs, Americans of Sikh ancestry, were targeted for acts of violence or harassment. One poor fellow in Phoenix was gunned down. They wear turbans. They also wear, I believe they're called kirpan, which are tiny ornamental daggers. They have two of them as part of their regalia. And the symbolism of the kirpan is really quite interesting. One of them symbolizes the indefeasible individual right to armed self-defense. And the other one symbolizes the responsibility to defend the rights of the helpless. So I find that quite commendable. I don't have any brief for Sikh theology or for its religious customs, but I do find something commendable about the symbolism in their accoutrements. I find it commendable that if you are in a community where there is a Sikh temple and you are hungry, they will feed you. All you have to do is simply show up and accept what is provided to you and do your best to help out. They don't expect monetary reward. They don't expect that you will adhere to their religion. They just expect maybe that you'll help wash the dishes and maybe put away the chairs in exchange for feeding you. The Sikhs, as it happens, historically, have not been treated well by the Muslims. There have been more than a few incidents in history where Sikhs have been on the receiving end of religious violence perpetrated by Muslims and by others. And the Sikh-Hindu relations are not particularly good either. But it really is a staggering instance of irony compounded by stupidity that a Sikh who comes to this country and lives a productive life, law-abiding, community-minded life, finds himself being assaulted and accused of being a Muslim terrorist when he's neither. My experience has been that the Sikhs are some of the least offensive, most generous, most peaceable people I've ever come to know. When I was in Wisconsin, I used to work out at a facility called Club West. And one of the people with whom I played basketball was a local neurosurgeon of Sikh ancestry. One of the things that you notice about a Sikh is that the males wear their hair very long. It reminds me a little bit, quite frankly, of the way that the priesthood in the Greek Orthodox Church wear their hair. They wear their hair long and braided. The Sikhs are somewhat similar. There are some theories to the effect that the Sikh religion may have been founded by a soldier of one of the Crusades who ended up in that part of India and taught the precepts of the Sermon on the Mount to people in that part of India. I don't know if that's true or not. What I do know is that in terms of the way that they comport themselves with respect to other people, they're very much practitioners of the Golden Rule and very much inclined to obey the Second Great Commandment. So I find that, once again, to be entirely worthwhile and endearing, whatever else I think about their religion. But these are two examples of things that are happening more frequently because of the way that the public atmosphere is being tuned to set Americans off against Americans of the Muslim faith. And that's not a good thing. That's not going to lead us anywhere we should want to go. It's part of the process of cultivating a permanent state of war hysteria. And it's one of the oldest tricks in the playbook of collectivists and tyrants of any variety. Of course, it's a species of divide and conquer, but it's also of the nature of what H.M. Mencken described as creating hobgoblins against which we seek the protection of the state, even when we have a state that's in the business of manufacturing hobgoblins. And that's inescapably part of this conversation. Yes, Islam is a troublesome religion. Yes, there are many contemptible things that Muhammad did and then later on sanctified in the name of religious revelation. And you can find other examples of man-made religions where that's very much the case. Yes, the world would be better off if Islam were somehow to reform itself in the direction of what we would consider to be civility. Yes, there's a history of violence in the Islamic religion, but you know what? the conduct of Christians, of which I am one, has not really provided a gold standard historically in terms of treating our neighbors well and living up to the principles we profess. But let's not neglect the fact that the government ruling us for reasons of profit and cynical advantage has spent the last several decades doing what it can to nurture and cultivate and husband and exploit the worst elements of the Muslim world, taking what had been a disagreeable religion and weaponizing it. That is the perverse accomplishment of the government now supposedly protecting us against the menace that it has helped to foment. This is Will Grade, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll go to the phones immediately in the beginning of the next segment, so please stick around and join me if you can. Is our call number. Robert from Colorado is with us this evening. Good evening, Robert. Welcome to the program.
You hate the white man.
What's that? Must be it. Actually, I'm half white. I guess I'm an Oreo.
You can always tell when someone has a weak argument when they say it four times. And I think I lost count after the fourth time she said that.
Yeah, that must be it.
I've heard that woman. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think that repetition of that sort is not a hallmark of a mind that's fully functional. You've got
I think I've heard her voice somewhere before. She sounds vaguely familiar.
Okay. In her defense, let me venture this in her defense. When she is exorcised about what happens in the name of Sharia law, she's got a point. I mean, there are horrible things that are done in the name of Sharia law. Many of them are the products of tribal cultures that antedated Islam and that fed into it. I mean, Muhammad really took from the ambient in which he lived and created his religion based on the tribal myths and partially understood biblical stories to which he'd been exposed as a traitor. So there is something to be said for the idea that when you combine Islam being native to that region with certain practices that are not necessarily Islamic, there are bad things that happen, perfectly horrible things that go on. And there is much about the behavior of Muhammad that I would consider to be thoroughly barbaric. The problem here, from where I sit, is that Western intervention has been retarding a reformation in the Islamic world by seeking out the worst elements in the Muslim world and turning them into, you know, potentates and monarchs and policymakers. And the Saudi regime, the Saudi royal family, would still be squatting somewhere on a sand dune if it hadn't been for the fact that the Brits went in there and the American oil companies went in and turned them into a dynasty. And then back in 1990, 1991, we sent a 500,000-man army into the desert in order to defend the Saudis and the Kuwaiti Emirate. And since that time, we've been behaving like dinies, if you will, by not only promoting and protecting the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and such like, but also by promoting Sharia law at gunpoint in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And I don't know why people can't see that those are two parts of the same problem, but that's just me, I suppose.
In other words, you criticize someone, but then you turn right around and go and break bread with them.
It's not merely criticizing someone. It's almost as if they talent scout the worst elements and they turn them into partners and they turn them into agents of policy. Whether you're talking about what happened in the Balkans in the 1990s, where in Bosnia you had the CIA and MPRI, the Military Professional Resources Incorporated, sort of a Blackwater-type outfit, working to help install an Islamic regime in the former Yugoslavia and Bosnia, and then in Kosovo. They bombed the Serbs for 78 days in 1999 to turn Kosovo over to a group of people allied with bin Laden. And then you see what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan and what's going on elsewhere in the world, what's going on in Somalia right now with Ethiopia acting as a Western surrogate. They're deliberately, it seems to me, once again, seeking out, developing, refining, and empowering the worst elements in the Muslim world, and helping to turn 1.5 billion people against us in a conflict that's by no means inevitable. And in the process of doing so, they're holding back a reformation that's badly needed in that part of the world.
Great point. Thanks for bringing up Kosovo. That reminds me, I was flipping channels today and caught the tail end of Bowling for Columbine. Did you mention you'd seen that before?
Which one?
Bowling for Columbine.
Yeah, I've seen parts of it. I've not seen the whole thing.
Okay. But it's been out since 2002, 2003, I think. It's been several years. But I kind of refresh my memory. One point that struck me that was mentioned in the movie, and you just touched on it. The same day that Columbine went down, April 20th, 1999, you know what else happened on that day?
Well, April 20th is Hitler's birthday. I'm aware of that.
Right. But on that year, 1999, that was the same day that Clinton leveled that aspirin building in Kosovo.
Yeah, that's right. And the two Columbine killers had expressed the desire to join the military and start killing Serbs, hadn't they?
Yeah, hell of a coincidence, huh?
Yeah.
Ain't nothing coincidental.
Well, the thing about this that kills me is that why would they be killing Serbs? The Serbs in question, whatever you think of that government, the government was wretched. Governments are wretched. Just say that categorically. But the government in Kosovo, or in Serbia under Milosevic was a pretty wretched government. But for the most part, the Serbs are Orthodox Christians. And so you had a situation here where Orthodox Christians have been sort of a front line in the historical conflict with Islam in the Balkans, were being bombed by Washington and putative Christian powers in NATO in order to install a group of dope-dealing Islamo-Leninists called the Kosovo Liberation Army that had been identified by the State Department as a terrorist group. And you have people who, out of reflexive jingoism, believe that, well, the thing to do, obviously, is to start killing more Christian Serbs.
Good point.
It's really
good point.
Really difficult to see how that's not serving the interests of promoting Sharia law, quite frankly, if that's how you want to frame the issue.
Good point. You remember the dust-up a couple of weeks back about Doc Laura and her...
Yeah. The N-word?
Yeah. She was on CNN three, 4 days after that when she announced she was going to retire at the end of the year, or resign, or whatever you want to call it. And quite frankly, that's fine with me, because I can't stand the woman. She says nothing I want to hear. But she said something during this interview on CNN that just absolutely floored me. The guy was beating her up about what she said, and quite frankly, I think she's right. It is her First Amendment right to talk like she wants. I don't care one way or another. But during that conversation with the woman she was talking to at the time, she went on to say, and I'm paraphrasing here, I would have thought, this is Dr. Laura talking, paraphrasing, I would have thought that once we elected a black president, that all talk of racism would have gone away. Continue paraphrasing.
So,
not only has it not gone away, it has intensified. And I thought, damn, that's a good point.
That's a very good point, yeah. It's really sort of difficult to make the proposition that this culture is innately, insuperably racist when you take a look at the powers of the modern presidency and the fact that a pretty large plurality of the electorate was in favor of electing a black man as president. As a matter of fact, there in concept, there's very few people who thought that that was a bad idea. It's the particular background and personality of this black president that has created a lot of controversy and a lot of pushback, I think. And there are elements of the Republican Party who are trying to exploit this and nurture it. But you'd think, given that the president of the United States is the most powerful mammal on the planet, and that the powers that he exercises are really incomparable to any other office in human history, the fact that the United States of America elected a black man of somewhat exotic background to hold that position would mean that we're over one of the major elements of that problem, if not that problem outright. But it's just too profitable to play the race card from whatever vantage point you're looking at it. There's just too much political capital to be gained by getting people to think of themselves as government-defined ethnic collectives.
And oh, I agree. That's a game that's playing the race card is very profitable. Hell, how do you think Jesse Jackson got to where he is?
Sure.
That put a lot of dollars in his pocket.
It wasn't his peerless intellect and his winning personality.
Well,
it had
something
to do with
the
Ford Foundation, too, I think.
He's a great orator, but he's clearly a race pimp.
Well, you know, Jesse Jackson's oratorical style reminds me of that line from Candida about how one shouldn't let the rhyme dictate the reason. But in terms of the way that he has conducted himself, he is very much a racial extortionist. And
I agree.
He's very much, I think, a paradigm of how that game is played in the whole Ford Foundation-funded racial apparatus. Hey, Robert, are you going to stick with us at the break?
No, I think I'm good. Talk to you next week.
Okay. Well, thanks for calling in. Good to hear from you. God bless. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back at you in just a couple of minutes, so stick around.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
At the risk of detonating some potentially incendiary personalities, I have to say that I feel as if I'm going to go all Samuel L. Jackson here. I am sick and tired of this mother-blanking mosque at mother-blanking Ground Zero, but apparently we have to talk about that because Newt Gingrich won't let us do otherwise. If there has ever been a more palpably insincere public figure than Newt Gingrich, I'm not aware of him. He doesn't believe anything he says. That much is clear on the basis of a lengthy, detailed, and altogether plausible Esquire profile that was published just a couple of weeks ago. He doesn't believe anything apart from, apparently, that he has been anointed by history to be the tutor of the rest of us. And he is now enjoying a sinecure at the American Enterprise Institute, which is one of the most influential of the neoconservative, neo-Trotsky, that's a better description, Babbitt Warrens in Washington, D.C. He's the guy who started this business about the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. And my inbox, and no doubt many of you have inboxes like this, is overflowing with forwarded copies of his July 21st statement that begins, "There should be no mosque near Ground Zero in New York so long as there are no churches or synagogues in Saudi Arabia. The time for double standards that allow Islamists to behave aggressively toward us while they demand our weakness and submission is over." Where's the act of aggression there? Is building a mosque an act of aggression? "The proposed Cordoba House overlooking the World Trade Center site," stop right there, that's a lie, it would not overlook the World Trade Center site, "where a group of jihadists killed over 3,000 Americans and destroyed one of our most famous landmarks is a test of the timidity, passivity, and historic ignorance of American elites. For example, most of them don't understand that Cordoba House is a deliberately insulting term. It refers to Cordoba, Spain, the capital of Muslim conquerors who symbolized their victory over the Christian Spaniards by transforming a church there into the world's third largest mosque complex. Today, some of the mosque's backers insist that this term is being used to symbolize interfaith cooperation when, in fact, every Islamist in the world recognizes Cordoba as a symbol of Islamic conquest. It is a sign of their contempt for Americans and their confidence in our historic ignorance that they would deliberately insult us this way. Those Islamists and their apologists who argue for religious toleration are arrogantly dishonest. They ignore the fact that more than 100 mosques already exist in New York City. Meanwhile, there are no churches or synagogues in all of Saudi Arabia," which, by the way, is not under the jurisdiction of any government in the United States. "In fact, no Christian or Jew can even enter Mecca, and they lecture us about tolerance." Well, you know what? No non-Mormon can go to a Mormon temple. That's not intolerance. That's simply a tenet of that faith. People who self-select to join the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and who live according to the tenets of that faith and who are deemed and certified to be suitable to do so can enter LDS temples after they've been dedicated. Mecca is the equivalent of a temple, the central place of the Islamic religion. Why would any Jew or Christian want to go to Mecca? I don't want to go to Mecca. I don't want to have anything to do with Mecca. It doesn't offend me in any way, shape, form, or sense that I wouldn't be permitted to go to Mecca unless I became a Muslim, which I will never do. This is a perfect example of trying to contrive offense where no offense need exist. Now, Newt Gingrich seems to have categorical insight into the unspoken and undocumented motivations of the people behind this when he talks about the way that the building of this Muslim YMCA would be interpreted as a symbol of conquest. That assumes, of course, that we're going to be playing by their rules. It's only if we play by their rules that we would recognize it as a symbol of conquest. Why would we want to play by their rules instead of our rules? By our rules, it would be another building. It would have no significance to us. Those of us who don't belong to the Muslim faith, it would have no significance to us other than the fact that somebody had actually taken an old and currently all but worthless piece of commercial real estate and created jobs in a very, very bad, depressed economy to build a multi-story community center that would include a worship space for Muslims, but would be open to everybody, unlike Mecca. There would be Hebrew classes taught at the Cordoba House. There would be a yoga studio. Yoga, of course, is not compatible with the tenets of Islam. Not terribly compatible with the tenets of Christianity either, once the religious subtext is made noticeable, but that's a different topic for a different time. It's only if we accept the premises of Islamism that we could take offense at the building of the Cordoba House. We would be handing them a victory if we insist on interpreting this the way they would rather than the way we should. And the way that we should interpret this for purposes of public policy is the way that Thomas Jefferson would interpret it. Let my neighbor believe in no God or 20, as long as he neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. Pocket picking and leg breaking represent the threshold question here. If no aggression is committed, and what is not aggressing by committing acts of premeditated commerce, which is what this is ultimately about, if no aggression takes place, there's no public issue that can be suitable for government intervention. But this is how Gingrich addresses the issue, or how he addressed it, rather, in an interview a couple of days ago, talking to David Barton. David Barton, of course, is one of the leading lights of the religious right. He is one of the chief advisors to Glenn Beck, who I guess is trying to promote himself as a species of, what, public evangelist now. On Wall Builders Live, it's a radio program co-hosted by David Barton and an associate by the name of Rick Green, Gingrich said the following when asked how to go about preventing the construction of the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, of which I am so heartily sick. Well, there are a lot of places, replied Gingrich. I think the Congress has the ability to declare the area a national battlefield memorial because I think we should think of the World Trade Center as a battlefield site. This is a war. Well, no, it's not. Not until Congress declares it to be, is it a war. The attorney, and incidentally, that would not be a battlefield unless you're willing to turn the entire outlying region to a depth of two or three blocks or more into a battlefield site. I wonder how the business owners within that area would react to the idea that their property is now going to be federalized and turned into a national battlefield. Now, one of the shibboleth, litmus paper type tests of what you are in terms of being either a statist or a believer in individual liberty is the fundamental question of property rights. And Gingrich does not believe in property rights. He no more believes in property rights than Marx, Engels, and Lenin believed in property rights. He continues, the Attorney General of New York, Andrew Cuomo, could intervene because, frankly, he has the ability to slow it down for decades if he wants to. Ah, yes, suffocate, strangle, incapacitate, use dilatory tactics just to shut the thing down through attrition. I believe that Carl Paladino, a would-be Republican nominee for governor in the state of New York, wants to use eminent domain simply to steal the property and turn it into a shrine to Ares, the god of war. That's the same idea, basically. Let the government steal the property. Gingrich continues, I am surprised that Mayor Bloomberg said it was okay, and I think that if he reconsiders it, he'll decide not. He'll decide it's not okay. In other words, he's just not thinking clearly. And when he thinks clearly, he'll come to understand that the best thing to do is simply to shut down this this development. There are a number of different steps that could be taken, Gingrich concludes. There's no reason this has to occur. And whether it's city, state, or federal, there are plenty of ways for America to stop it. Well, all you do is you have to deny property rights, the validity of contracts, the validity of honest, peaceful commerce. Shouldn't we be encouraging, if our mission is to civilize Muslims, shouldn't we be encouraging them to play according to our rules? We recognize property rights. We recognize freedom of religion. We protect these things by law. We recognize that when people are involved in peaceful, mutually beneficial commerce, that the only role of government is to ensure that neither force nor fraud is used to confer an illegal advantage on one party to the transaction or the other. Isn't that what we should be doing? Aren't those our principles? Aren't those our values? Instead, what Gingrich is saying is that we should approach this by assuming that we're going to be playing by the rules dictated by the Islamists. Unless we betray our principles, unless we betray the Constitution and the state constitution of New York with the cognate provisions having to do with property rights and religious freedom, unless we're willing to set those aside and play according to the totalitarian rules that the Islamists would dictate, if we don't do that, then we will suffer a strategic defeat in a war against those same Islamists. You see, that's what statists always do. They define the spectrum. They define the permissible alternatives in such a way that the only menu of choices from which we can select advance the proposition that government is all-powerful. And Gingrich is a past master of that kind of deception. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397 on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and so I'd like you to stick around and call in if you get a chance. Be back in just a minute. Let's say, and why not, that you find yourself in a fight with a really nasty guy who's attacked you without provocation, at least as far as you can tell. You've done nothing consciously to provoke this guy. And your antagonist manages to land a really solid punch. What do you do? What's your reaction? Assuming, of course, that you're hurt, but you're not totally incapacitated. Do you let out a loud groan as the blow connects, fall to your knees and complain piteously about the unfairness of it all? Or do you shake it off and try to put the scumbag down? Which of those two do you do? Now, if your answer is A, chances are you're either a jobber in a professional wrestling performance trying to sell a phony punch, or perhaps you're William Shatner at his Virginia-cured, uninhibited best in a vintage Star Trek fight scene, which is sort of the same thing. Or, to extend the principle just a little bit, you're Newt Gingrich. You're any of these people who are trying to cultivate this sense of incurable self-pity over what happened on September 11th, 2001. It was a horrible thing. 3,000 people were murdered. That's a horrible thing, but you know what? It didn't destroy us. And it didn't demonstrate a capacity on the part of enemies abroad to destroy us. But yet every single year we have to endure this repulsive, ritualized festival of collectivist self-pity. As if that's what's going to define us as a country into the foreseeable future. We're so weak, so fragile, so vulnerable, that if we're true to our professed principles regarding the sanctity of private property and the inviolability of the right to worship, if we're true to those principles, we'll be conferring power upon our enemies to redefine who we are in the direction of totalitarian Islam. Unless we abandon the principles that define us as a constitutional republic, the terrorists will win. If we allow this mosque to be built, if we don't contrive some way to deny property rights, we'll be sending a message that we have submitted because our situation is just that precarious. The enemy that still seeks to destroy us is stealthily acquiring the means to do so. You know, we are a good and compassionate nation We were attacked without warning or provocation or cause by people who just hate us for our decency. Their hatred for us is their favorite repast, and it's the dessert course after every meal. Every waking moment is filled with a desire to destroy us because of our freedom and decency. And when exhausted at night, our enemies lay their heads on their pillows. Their dreams are completely consumed by the desire to destroy us because of our goodness and decency. And their powers are formidable. They're all but invincible. And our existence is so thoroughly imperiled. We're so completely compassed about by this all-powerful enemy that the presence of a Muslim YMCA hundreds of yards away from the still gaping hole where the towers once stood would be that increment of ugliness that would lead to the complete collapse of our society. Pity us, for we are weak. That's the message that people like Gingrich and Palin are sending. Are you happy with this? Is that what you're willing to settle for? As opposed to making a defiant proclamation of your belief in first principles? Are you willing to say that we are so pitilessly helpless, or so pitiably helpless, rather, or so pathetically, pitiably helpless, that if we recognize the sanctity of property rights in this instance, we're doomed? Or would you defiantly say we're strong enough, we're powerful enough in our convictions that we don't need to take notice of this? That people abroad make of it what they will. We don't really care because we're playing by our rules. And our rules say that if you've bought the property, if you paid good money for it in good faith, and you're going to make peaceful, productive use of it, albeit a use that we may not appreciate in terms of the religion being practiced, that's your deal, not ours, and the world just keeps on spinning. That really is how Americans worthy of the name would react to this. Rather than allowing their minds to be clotted with partially digested and largely invidious depictions of the failings of that man-made religion, which are plentiful, numerous, and genuine, obsessing over the exact size, shape, and consistency of what is essentially a moat, while ignoring the beams that are occluding our vision with respect to the shortcomings of the system under which we live, and our performance, our adherence to the principles that we profess, you know what? 3,000 people were murdered on September 11th. It's a horrible thing. If you were to run an analysis, I've made this point before, that amortizes the death rate in Iraq since the war to protect and to restore the Emirate of Kuwait began in 1991, from 1991 to 2003, that country endured the equivalent of a 9/11 every single damn day. You know, in Lebanon, in 2006, in Beirut, there was an invasion by the Israelis that resulted in thousands of casualties and the forced exodus of over 1 million people. In proportionate terms, that was a much larger body count than what we suffered in September of 2001. They're rebuilding Beirut, the government of Lebanon, which is nominally an Arab country. You have, an Arab president and a Christian prime minister. Lebanon is a completely unworkable polity. Somebody once said that the best definition by example of the term oxymoron is the phrase Lebanese government. That being the case, let's move on. The Lebanese government is rebuilding Beirut. There are thousands of people who were killed in Beirut. Beirut was really, if you will, sort of a ground zero in the Israeli invasion of, I believe it was July and August of 2006, in retaliation for rocket attacks by Hezbollah into Israel. One of the buildings being rebuilt is a synagogue. It's in the middle of that section of Beirut that was subjected to saturation bombing by the Israeli Air Force. The Israeli Air Force blew up the synagogue in Beirut. The government of Lebanon is rebuilding the synagogue in Beirut for a minuscule population. About 500 or 600 Jewish people live in Lebanon. They're building a ground zero synagogue. They're not treating this as a gesture of submission to the Israelis. They're not treating this as symbolic of a victory of Israeli arms or Jewish nationalism, pan-Zionist nationalism. They're rebuilding the synagogue because there are Jewish people who live in Beirut who use it as a house of worship. It was destroyed in the course of this invasion, and because they want to create out of Beirut a city that will be attractive to investment capital. In other words, they're committing an act of capitalism by rebuilding that synagogue in the middle of their ground zero. This is being done by an Arab country, a weak, divided Arab country, whose existence has been imperiled by repeated invasions by Syria and Israel, sometimes with the backing of the United States government. They're far braver than we are, apparently. Oddly enough, they seem to be more interested in promoting what we should call American values in this instance. That's something to think about. When people in that set of circumstances, from that background, are willing to behave that way, and yet the people who are the chest-thumping jingoists of the Republican Party are trying to tell us that we are so hopelessly weak, we are so thoroughly, existentially threatened that we can't adhere to the values we profess. We just can't afford to. Good grief, we're a nation of 300 million people. The largest and most expensive military apparatus in human history is the possession of the government ruling us. And supposedly, if we quote-unquote permit this Muslim community center to be built in New York City, that will mean the end of our existence as a Christian country, supposedly. You know what? 8 weeks from now, nobody will remember this melodrama. It will disappear. It will be as evanescent as a handful of snowflakes. That's because the whole purpose of this is to try to railroad people into the voting booth to pull the lever for the Republican Party, the same Republican Party, ironically enough, that has been promoting Sharia law for the last decade or longer. Thanks so much for joining me this evening. Please join me online at Pro Libertate, the blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. If you care to and have the means, there's a PayPal button there to donate. Many of you have done so, and I am eternally grateful for your help. Have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow. I'll be back with you in a week. And until then, as always, Dum Spiro Pugno. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, and God bless.